parte más terrible. La parte más terrible. Marrón. Terrible.
¿Quién más en el que le iba a sentir? ¿Ella? ¿Quién más en el que le iba a sentir? ¿Ella? Tiene más en el que la iba a sentir. Ella tiene más en el que la iba a sentir. Ella tiene más en el que la iba a sentir. Ella, 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 ella.
Thank you. The project of a united Europe as conceived after the Second World War is largely exhausted. Little credibility remains in the fictions of that cunning of European reason that believed it could overcome the causes of the continent's historical tragedy: war, dictatorship and fascism, exploitation and inequality, colonialism and racism, by emphasizing the virtues of social market economy and the old geopolitical combination of the state rather than through a decisive constituent proposal. The causes of this situation are varied and enormously complex, but from the historical point of view, it is possible to identify certain landmark events in this long agony. On the one hand, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War, which reduced the need for a united Europe that was equally anti-Soviet and anti-fascist. And on the other, the shift towards neoliberal ideas in the European Union process during the 90s and the failure of the European constitution process, which contributed to a generalized feeling of indifference among the citizenry and disenchantment with the European project. This explains the establishment, under the pretext of the global debt crisis, of what Etienne Balibar has called the commissarial dictatorship of the Troika. There is a new abduction of Europe, but not through the cleverness of Zeus, who, charmed by the Phoenician woman named Europa, abducts her so he can show her the pleasure and glory of the Greek kingdom. This time, it is financial logic that has abducted her, and in return has set an unpayable price: democracy, social rights, the emancipation of the victims of colonialism, equality and brotherhood on the continent. But as the dream of European reason fades, the time of monsters begins. Whether beloved or condemned, the European Union is an allusion, albeit in an imperfect and contradictory one, to the emancipatory traditions of this continent since the Enlightenment. A Europe united by the ideas of social and political emancipation, a Europe that goes beyond the national borders of the post-colonial states and the traditions of war and periodic destruction. The attempted return to the sovereignty of nation-state in the current financial and institutional catastrophe creates a kind of mirage that makes it easy to forget that in Europe, sovereignty, nationalism and war have always been inseparable. The event, the new abduction of Europe, debt, war, democratic revolutions, hopes to lay the foundations for a radically new European cultural and political agency, driven by the urgency of the situation. It seems futile to call for a Eurocentric humanist consciousness if such consciousness is incapable of reflecting the non-Europe within Europe, the results and challenges of its colonial, imperialistic and fascist past, of the modifications taking place in the world system and of the end of liberal public spheres and the emergence of the network of networks. It is vital that we call for new actors. It has likely been both the world of cultural and artistic production and the new movements of cognitive and creative work squeezed between increasing instability and individualization, and also the social movement of migration, which has confronted us with the post-colonial skeleton in Europe's closet, which have practiced and theorized Europe as the smallest possible expression of consistency in the political realm over the last two decades. Perhaps we should examine the Arab Springs, or movements such as Spain's May 15th protests, Syntagma Square in Greece, or the events at Istanbul's Taksim Gezi Park, to revive hopes for a European spring that can bring an end to the current nightmare. It is impossible to think about a European future without first examining, interpreting and disseminating these experiences, which are not a thing of the past, but are fully alive and absolutely of the present.
That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast. That's the sound. sound of the police. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound.
And
it's such a pleasure to listen to Ada. It's so fantastic to hear that these struggles that we can, yes, we can. The question is how. And for us, on a work level, with undocumented service workers in the United States, there was a tremendous social and political experiment. An experience of union transformation, because the unions were very rigid. They need to change. They needed to be changed, because they're not going to change on their own. There need to be movements and people who support a sort of diverse social syndicalism that force them and pressure them and provide guidelines for possibility that allow that to happen. So on an institutional level, we need to demand and reclaim a new kind of syndicalism. What did that mean? In the late 90s and early 2000s, in the sector of cleaning and service work, also private security. Workers were living a tremendous level of precarization, especially the California and Colorado largely undocumented migrant cleaning staff. People felt totally delegitimized to work without papers. How am I possibly going to organize? And yet, the kind and the style of campaign that we conducted managed, really won a lot of victories. And now we can say that we're hundreds of thousands of workers in the cleaning service and private security sectors who have organized through this model, also services in airports, also in the public sector, and also in educational sectors and others. So the sort of open source model, a very open model of organization, describes the requirement to mobilize ourselves. The cleaning workers specifically worked within or organized ourselves within our workplace, but also outside of our workplace. This is a very important tactic, which we have organization in the neighborhoods and the homes of the workers, providing a cartography of where are we, who are we, these workers, and what does it mean to make a movement with the neighborhood, with the church, with all, a whole network of where we live, where we reproduce ourselves, and not struggle alone. So I believe that the mareas, the tides, the citizen tides that we've seen in Spain, this is very similar to what we've been doing for a long time, working both within and outside of the institutions, but creating a grassroots citizen movement, and especially create intelligent campaigns. It's not a matter of simply mobilizing ourselves in the street, training ourselves, providing committees. It's very important to train ourselves. We need resources. We need to learn. We need to politicize ourselves by talking about things. Workers are much more intelligent than the union that's supposed to represent them. People understand very clearly their own situation, and asking questions and analyzing together, we can understand where the problem lies. And this collectivity opens us to our analysis. And our campaigns are really important, the possibility of reproducing them in other countries. Justice for Janitors launched similar projects in Holland, in the UK, in other places within the same sectors, but facing the same international multinational companies that were hiring them, whether in private security or in cleaning services. The idea is that we have to conduct campaigns which have a very keen sense of strategy. For us, union research or understanding very clearly how the enemy functions, the flows of capital, the flows of power, and not simply go out into the street and go on strike ourselves, but also understand their interests, understand their expansion, and understand their whole business plan, because we have to intervene not only on a mediatic level, on the level of the media or of the neighborhood, but also we have to go to where they reproduce themselves, where capital, where the whole business plan is unfolding, the different lobby groups that attack workers' movements and the fundamental rights of workers. We need to understand them. We need to draw good maps of how they produce and reproduce themselves, understand their flows and attack them in very different ways all at the same time. So these are tactics, these are strategies of movement. We need to understand that there are legal strategies, regulatory strategies, also mobilizations. We need to be able to mobilize the users, the consumers. We need to do political campaigns and also media campaigns that aren't sort of the typical union speaking, but people, individuals who represent and who are effectively the society itself. These are strategies which are not so mediated by the institution. It's the movement itself which speaks and which reproduces itself. So understanding how to struggle, understanding that we need to have a capacity to land, to put our feet on the ground, and to win. If we don't win, the movement doesn't advance because we get tired, we lose faith, we lose our organizational muscle, which is our intelligence. We need to be intelligent. We need to think about how to attack, how to struggle, how to pressure our opponent, whoever that is. We can't be exhausting. We need to create music, art, good spirit, be alive, allow help people to feel alive by participating. So Justice for Janitors is reproducing itself in Europe. There are now sectorial networks, so we can really group together against certain multinational organizations in the United States, in Europe, but also globally. This continues to reproduce itself. Our work is teaching, learning, and providing a mechanism that is then adapted, that can be adapted to different contexts. Understand why things fail, why they function or don't function in given contexts. These tools are tremendously important. They allow the movement to replicate itself and to think about how to sustain ourselves. We have this constant question about resources and about sustainability. We've confronted this in what I think is an intelligent way. And now I want to talk about how to braid these different spaces of power together. For us, these campaigns on a global level have been an exercise in how to coordinate ourselves, how to create a movement which recognizes itself in different places. And service workers, again, these are workers who are not those who fit into the classic model of labor organizing, but this requires global campaigns which have won agreements on an international level, using this kind of local nodes in a network, arm them with a campaign to work and to win on a local level for objectives which we want to learn, but also allow those who are not yet unionized to reach agreements. So this model is helping us in, for example, public sectors, this kind of social syndicalization we're looking at in Holland, struggling against cutbacks, especially in healthcare, in nursing homes, in daycare centers for elderly people, and also for home-based care. And the union began organizing some years ago, and it's now in a position to respond more actively as a movement. So as we mobilize ourselves, not only with the workers, but also with the patients, with the families, with the elderly people who are affected, and allowing them to be the protagonists of the struggle, because it's a collective struggle which has a public support at a very broad level. And the union has been able to stop some of the cutbacks and put limits on, for example, the salaries that the CEOs and the managers are receiving. So what does it mean to confront privatization in, for example, healthcare at a European and at a global level? People in Madrid have done this incredibly. The citizen tides it's not only the union that can make these changes. It's very important to see also citizen movements that do this. On the level of gigantic international and disgusting corporations, which are aiming for the public healthcare sectors, who are our common enemies? How do we create, starting now, networks that can confront them and begin talking on a European level about so unionism has to renovate itself, has to update itself, but it has to think about new ways of carrying out dialogues on a European level, who are carrying out these campaigns on a European level. I'd also like to talk a little bit on new challenges, new campaigns. There's a campaign going on now in the United States, which are fast food workers in the United States. Many of them are young African-American or Latino people who are earning below minimum wage, and they're starting to organize. They're starting to carry out strikes in many cities, and we're organizing through the social media, Facebook, etc. And we're creating, running experiments with how do we make decentralized movements, recognizing that individuals and small groups locally have to create their own struggles, but they also have to be connected and strategic. It can't be so horizontal that it doesn't work like a laser in a highly focused and concentrated way. So this campaign is, on the one hand, it's opened the debate about inequality in the United States and a debate about what is a living wage, what is a minimum wage. And these campaigns are creating a political consciousness. Some years ago, 40% of Americans or in the future, 40% of Americans will live on minimum wage. This is a condition which requires organization. For us, it's fundamental. And for those of us who are in this struggle, in this campaign, creating these strategies, we as a social movement, we need to put our feet on the ground. We need to understand that we can't work only on a symbolic level. We need to figure out exactly where we can deepen specific struggles and really be experts in how to win. If we don't deepen our knowledge in very specific struggles, I think that it's hard to put together a really sustainable counterpower. So it's important to provide and share these experiences, these things that we've achieved, but also understand that these are experiments that are ongoing, and we're continually entering new struggles. We need constantly to make new alliances with other struggles. And right now, on the level of labor, there's a frontal attack, and we need to update the way in which we organize ourselves, think about organizing precarious workers. This is a constant experiment. I think it's very important, and in the next years, I hope it will bear a lot of fruit. I have a tremendous hope, and I see this, at least from my perspective, as extremely positive, that there are major changes also in the unions, even though we often can't see it and we don't know it, the fact that these movements are possible is based on very intense relationship with social movements. For now, that's all. Good afternoon, good evening to all of you. First of all, I'd like to thank you for the invitation, and I have a terrible cold, and so I have this sort of cavernous voice. It's not my usual voice, but what can we do about it? I'll try to speak as clearly as I can. It's sort of difficult after the impassioned panel that went before us. It's sort of difficult to connect myself to the thread with some of the issues that are in my mind right now. I want to follow the thread of precarization and precariousness and focus the extraordinary vulnerability of European populations. Thinking on the basis of a vulnerable subject is not the same. It's sort of a 180-degree turn from the traditional way of thinking, which the traditional bourgeois notion, which starts with the subject, the autonomous, self-defining, self-determined subject. And when we try to think from there, it seems as if this form of thinking brings us to a sense of impotence. I'm a vulnerable, a fragile subject. I'm potentially impotent. And one of the frequently visited efforts by the philosophical tradition is to displace that fragility. And there's a whole canon of work on death that thinks about this, as you all know. But what I'm interested in thinking about here is not so much that shift, but picking up a bit the thread that Isabel has mentioned. If we think about a highly developed capitalist, a ferocious, bestial, highly developed capitalism, this means an increase, an incredible geometrical progression of human vulnerability, the vulnerability of ordinary human beings. So when we talk about the dismantlement of the welfare state, obviously turning healthcare into a business, a for-profit business, obviously makes human life more vulnerable. So vulnerability is not an anthropological observation about the human condition, which we simply must accept and live with. Vulnerability is the effect of policies, which what they do is remove the protections, removing the measures of protection and self-protection, which over centuries were conquered and constructed, sometimes through the state, sometimes through networks, cooperations, friendships, families, kinship, even in an institution which we all may have such strong opinions against, such as the family. So if we look at social movements, and specifically a social movement such as the one that Ada Colau has described, we might manage this transformation from fragile, terrified subjects without a dime to their name. We are transformed through this collective action into beings with consciousness, empowerment, capacity, even economic capacity to carry forward our own lives, because what is in the center of the capture by contemporary capitalism, it's our lives. It's not just our houses. It's not just our health. It's not just our transformation or our pensions, for those of us who are concerned about that, with a few white hairs on our heads. It's the question of being able to carry forward a minimally dignified life with certain possibilities for well-being, for sustainability of ordinary life. So as far as I can see, the question of vulnerability is key, because it allows us to open up this thread of how struggles in contemporary capitalism are not struggles to improve our economic well-being, such as struggles for improvement in salaries or wages. They're struggles to sustain and to reinforce the life that we have. This is not the individual life of each one of us, that this is a life which is shared with others, shared from the very first moment of our lives. And this brings us to another question. It has been said, or at least I believe, that today there is no movement, there is no European movement. There's no one single European movement. There are struggles, and we've seen them over the last years, struggles in Greece, in Spain, in Portugal, in France, in Germany, in Italy, struggles which echo between each other. They resonate, they generate a certain repertoire of actions, but don't constitute a single movement. And there are those who
esa falta,
who may find that that's this lack,
objeto, digamos, o de nostalgia, o de melancolía,
the object of melancholy or sadness or nostalgia. For me, I don't see it that way. One of the lessons from the feminist movement was to convince us, not only through the theoretical criticism that we've made towards the philosophy of the one, which would be long and boring for me to describe right now, but it's helped us see that a movement, like the women's movements, the feminist movements, first of all, they're always diverse, they're always heterogeneous, they occur in different parts of the planet, but they have certain characteristics in common. We will not cease to struggle because what's in play is our lives. And therefore, we've learned that there isn't just one movement which brings us together, compacts us all into one, but rather these struggles, these movements should proliferate, should acquire very different forms of presenting themselves. They're shared more or less, in greater or lesser degrees, by many of the women who, in this world, don't want to limit ourselves to the role that was socially assigned to us. It's on the basis of this model, this kind of struggle, that we need to think about movements in Europe right now. For me, it would be a mistake to think about a single unified European movement which, upon the sounding of the trumpet, would mobilize all of the populations. As much as we may be concentrated in certain places, this power needs to be attacked from many different places through many different strategies. As Ada said, we need to know how to play on all the different levels, on the street, on the level of disobedience, through legal measures, etc. So this power, which in certain ways is concentrated in certain centers of power, it would be a mistake for us to oppose it with a single power that is in a mirror relationship with it, that behaves in a single way. We've experienced this, and we know the horrible consequences it brings. We've already played that game. The European movements have to be plural. They have to be alive, rich. They have to depart from many different places and be able to meet each other, to join in specific actions or specific moments. And in that sense, of course, I'll be the first to sign up for Ada's proposal. We need to think about this Europe-wide scratch or markage. There are two or three fundamental European problems. One is debt. I'd list it as the first of the problem, because debt not only affects our possibility of reproducing life for each of us, but also debt. We have to think about it as a relationship between debtors and creditors, and these are very unequally distributed. They may have the capacity, this equal distribution may break up Europe. It may put us in confrontation with each other. I hope that this will not lead to a third world war, although on the, in the East we can hear the bells ringing, there are drum beats, as some literary types would say, but generating a sort of European common sense which divides the continent between that part which is indecently rich, who are the creditors, and that part which is truly poor, and those are the debtors countries. So when we say we're not going to pay the debt, it means that some will not be paid back on their credits. And so this idea needs to be extended or transformed into a sort of European common sense. The debt is exploiting a whole sector of people and putting them in a situation which they cannot live. And in my opinion, if we were capable of opening in all its complexity, the notion of doubt, the problem of doubt, of debt, I'm sorry, the problem of debt, interpolating European citizens of Northern Europe who believe very firmly that debt must be paid as a strong bourgeois principle. We need to convince them that debt need not be paid, that there are rights, especially in certain cases, to not pay debts. So I have just 5 minutes, which is horrible. So I would say it's good that there's not just one single European movement. It's good that there are lots of different movements that depart from different points of departure. It's important for us to gather up that heterogeneity and that polymorphic protean capacity of a struggle in this continent and open up the European space beyond the possible European borders. Europe extends itself through North Africa. Sometimes it reaches South America. Sometimes it even reaches North America through a whole series of communities that exist there. So we need to keep that in our minds. And I want to link this question to when we talk about the abduction of Europe by the great effective powers, especially the financial powers. What kind of European democracy are we thinking about? And there I would say at least three things, very briefly. The first, I would like to propose in the context of the electoral campaigns, I'd like to pose a counter campaign. Our problems are debt, war at the borders, either a cold war or a hot war, and our problem is the precarization of our population and the insecurity that's being generated by the dismantling of the welfare state. It has nothing to do with having one or representative more in the European Congress. So our heads have to permit us to draw a line in the short, the medium, and the long term. In the short term, I would say we need this campaign. In the medium scale, I would talk about the occupation or at least the conquest of local powers wherever we can, in neighborhoods, cities, villages, towns, whatever we can. And in this medium scale, this medium term, I would reinforce all of the networks, the transversal networks we have, ecological ones, anti-eviction ones, feminist ones, all of these different networks which give us strength. And long term, this democratic revolution, which could create a Europe which has never existed, because the Europe from which we come is a colonial, imperial, racist, and patriarchal, and exploitative Europe. Thank you.